One of the topics that me and my brother discussed the other day was about the God of the Old Testament and how different he is from the God of the New Testament in terms of the way the Bible characterizes him.
Yep. Well, there's a problem with that, though.
Okay, I didn't even get into the thing, but go ahead.
Well, I mean, there's a problem with that basic thesis to start with, and it's a pretty common one, actually. It actually goes back to that notion of dividing the two characters of God into two different genres or two different characters. It goes back to a guy from the 2nd century named Marcion. And Marcion was a son of a wealthy ship owner from Pontus, which is sort of on the Black Sea. And he'd moved to Rome and had become a Christian and was part of this expanding Christian community in Rome in the early second century. But Marcion got really frustrated with this God of the Old Testament, this vengeful, anthropomorphic, you know, like jealous, angry, killing machine, which he kind of is. So Marcion decided that the problem was that you had two different deities. You had a god that was the creator of the world. The creator god is a god who is into justice, into retribution for wrongs done. He's not necessarily immoral. He's not bad, but he's not particularly praiseworthy either. And that for Marcion there was also a different god, an alien god that was. That existed outside of the realm of the created universe, and that that Jesus was the representative of that God, so that the God that Jesus proclaimed is a different.
This is Marcion's theory.
Yeah, this is Marcion's theory. So Marcion recommended then a rejection of the Old Testament. He also was the first to put together a canon, a New Testament. So his New Testament consisted of the Gospel of Luke, expunged of all references to the Greek Bible, and the letters of Paul, also expunged of certain things. And that was, for Marcion, that was the message of this alien god. And so he was labeled a heretic very early on by other people in the realm, and there were competing Marcionite and Orthodox churches for a long time. Marcion was very successful in this. And it actually spurred the production, it actually was one of the factors that spurred the production of what we call the New Testament. Early Christians didn't really, there was no impulse to build a canon to rival the Hebrew Scriptures at that point. And it took Marcion to kind of spur people both to try to reclaim Paul, which Paul had become kind of a marginal figure in early Christian theology up to that point, to reclaim Paul because Marcion had seen him as sort of the ideal apostle. And also to sort of begin to develop their own collection of received texts that they could count and call authoritative.
It's interesting that so much of what modern Christianity is based on seems to have, according to what you just said, in some ways been spawned or influenced by this one dude.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, like the Marcionite churches end up kind of disappearing all the time, swallowed up by proto-Orthodoxy. But ultimately, Marcion's main point, expunged of some of its cosmological references, ends up winning the day in most of our minds. Marcion's division of these two different characters of God, the Old Testament character and the New Testament character, has won. And that's how we think about it.
Okay, so what's the problem?
The problem is that you can read Mark 13, read Revelation. The God of the New Testament, the God of certain parts of the New Testament, is very nice and very into forgiving wrongs done and very into being, you know, friendly to people. But then in other sections of the New Testament, God's also just as big of an asshole as he is in the Old Testament.
So the response is he's actually kind of a dick throughout most of the Bible.
Yeah, but then if you go back to the prophetic literature, right, a lot of the sort of the nice images of God that we sort of see on the lips of Jesus of the Gospels is also in the prophets, in the minor prophets, where God can be comforting, God can be loving, God can be caring about the sufferings of his people. God can be concerned about bringing justice to the world where injustice, you know, reigns. So, you know, and that's where Jesus gets a lot of his influences. So, you know, there's a lot of the stuff that's in the New Testament that we like about the God of Jesus is in the Old Testament. And a lot of the stuff that's bad in the Old Testament is sort of motivating a vision of God in the New Testament. So, I mean, one can think of the bloodbath that is Revelation.
All right, let's hold that thought. We're done. All right, sorry, we got interrupted. So you were talking about a bloodbath?
Yeah, I mean, if you read the book of Revelation, right, the book of Revelation, barring all that ridiculous left behind stuff that is not really a particularly good reading of the text, the God of Revelation is just really seems to be looking forward to killing everybody. You know, I mean, it's not a pretty happy text. It's a pretty violent text that envisions the death of millions and millions of people out of a sense of retribution for their mistreatment of early Christians. So it's you know, it's not a happy text. The God of the New Testament isn't always happy and lovey-dovey. And you can even go back to, say, Mark 13. Mark 13 envisions God's catastrophic judgment of Jerusalem. And that's put on the lips of Jesus. I mean, Jesus isn't always the happy, you know, free-loving, you know, nice guy that we make him out to be. At least as he's presented in the synoptic tradition.
So does the diversity of the depictions of God to you, does that feel like it jives with current popular depictions or the way, you know, evangelicals typically speak of God, or do you think that there's some deficiency in how he's usually conceived?
I think that the one thing that a lot of evangelicals and conservatives get right about the God of the Bible is that the God of the Bible is violent in both the Old and New Testament, and it seems to me that a lot of fundamentalists and evangelicals are all too willing and eager to accept violence as a means to an end in a lot of contexts, and I think they do so with the warrant implicitly of the Bible. But I think that on that score, both the Bible and my conservative brothers and sisters are fundamentally wrongheaded. That a glorification of violence, particularly a violence that is directed at those who disagree with us, seems to me to be a really backward and unhelpful way of being in the world. And I would disagree with both. What I would say is the Bible is fundamental. It has an inconsistency about this, because you have a very violent God who occasionally advocates really happy, peaceful kinds of restorative justice. And I think the task of theological thinking in the present is how do we lift up those strains in the Bible and make those normative for how we behave in the world. I think that's the important thing, and to find ways to reject the other parts that are in my mind terrible.
So your solution is accept the good parts, ignore the bad parts, and everything else is just
ultimately, because that's what everyone does anyway. Right?
So you're just doing it in a specific and probably the most constructive way.
What I would say is that everyone when they interpret the Bible, they interpret some parts and they ignore others. One can even go back to Jesus for a warrant for this, where Jesus says, "You have heard it said this, but I say this." Paul similarly was someone who says, "Well, you thought that this meant this, but it actually refers to this." You know, for most Christians today, all of the Levitical laws we have, except for the ones against homosexuality, we seem to want to ignore all those, except the ones we want to keep. And we ignore them because we argue that, you know, that Jesus puts an end to the law. So then we can get rid of this part of the law, but maybe we keep the Ten Commandments, even though that's part of the law too. I mean, there's all these things where we are exceptionally inconsistent in how we read the text, and we do privilege other parts of the text over others as a means of
coming up with some cohesive...
As a means of creating coherence out of a text that's fundamentally incoherent as a single work, because it's written by lots of different people over a thousand years. So, what I would advocate is I would advocate doing essentially the same thing but being honest about it. I think, based upon my sense of what's important and how what I think is most important for how we live in the world, I think there are certain parts of the Bible that speak to that, and there are other parts that don't.
Does it not subvert the kind of omnipotence of God, though, to suggest that we are allowed, or that it might even benefit us, to take the good parts and ignore the bad parts of the Bible?
Well, to be honest, I'm not sure that God ever sanctioned the writing of a Bible anyway, if there is a God out there. people write in the name of God, and that's not necessarily, doesn't necessarily mean that that's a bad thing, that somehow the text is somehow invalid as a result of that, but, people write in the name of God all the time, they think they know what God tells them, and I think the important thing is about the Bible is that the different books of the Bible are the voices of individuals and communities that think that this is what God is saying to them in a particular moment. And I think the important thing is that these visions of God come out of a communal experience that's rooted in a particular location. And it, similarly to how people today confront how to bring their belief in God into line with how they live in the world, is that one does that in the context of the world in which one lives. And so I think we are always in the process of rewriting the text as we interpret it, rewriting it and reinterpreting it for the place in which we find ourselves. And that's what the people who wrote the Bible in the first place did, and that's what we continue to do. The way that one reads the text now as opposed to the way people read it in the Middle Ages is radically different. What was normal for us is not normal for them. What the issues confronting us are not the issues confronted them. But we can learn from their interpretations, we can learn from other people's interpretations, and we can try to find some means of discerning what the right way to live in the world is as part of a process. It's not necessarily being disrespectful to the text. The text is open to be interpreted. It's there to be read. It's there to be worked with. And we have to find ways to do that. So,
I mean, I guess the basic question is, if God is in fact all-powerful, couldn't he have created something that was more consistent?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's an argument I would have with him.
I mean, so he's either not all powerful, or he doesn't exist, or chose to create it this way for a specific reason.
I mean, the funny thing is that the God that is worshipped by so many of my more conservative brothers and sisters are people. That's a God that's like the show Lost. Like, it's a God that has all these weird, back channel ways of doing things that are all kind of mysterious and maybe probably don't ever resolve themselves in the end. I mean, it's just this ridiculous web of interconnected prophecies and...
Example.
Well, think about these dudes that really are into the end time scenarios, right?
Yeah.
That are constantly reading the headlines and looking for well, there's this image of a mosquito in Ezekiel 38, 37, and
okay, but
the
those
mosquito
people,
refers to... I mean, no,
those
but,
people are clearly insane.
No, but they're not insane, because who... I mean, the Left Behind series is exactly this way of thinking. It's these weird, elaborate, Lost-like fantasies about God's complicated plot for the end of the world, millions and millions of people read these damn things. I mean, and it's terrible. It's terrible interpretation of the text, and it's terrible. It's just terrible. But people like this stuff, people buy into it. People, envision God that way in a lot of ways. I think that if you believe in a God that is, an omnipotent, all knowing person, to be honest, I think he's going to have some explaining to do. He's not a particularly good communicator. Okay, when was the last time you talked to him, right? If he really knows what's going on, and ultimately, the God of the Bible doesn't claim to be omnipotent and omniscient in the way that we have sort of philosophically come to understand those concepts. He is a God that has emotions, that is occasionally able to be convinced to do other things. He can be persuaded. He can be talked down from a steroid rage. He can be.
Right.
he can be wrong. He can cry. You know, like this is not the God of the philosophers, who is this sort of detached, all-knowing, all-powerful God. He's a God that has limitations, and he's a God that is driven a lot of times by emotion and not by reason.
You have devoted your life to studying, you know, the history of religion and history of man's writings on religion and of God. You know, so when you look at how Christianity or American Christianity today, and how it's manifested in evangelical churches, for example, I mean, do you see them as like really misguided in the way that they preach and teach and go about trying to carry out the will of God? Because it seems like the answer to that question is yes, based on what you're saying. Because what you're saying, if I'm not mistaken, is that people looking for moral absolutism, or even any kind of certainty of God's will or his plan or whatever for our lives, people looking for that are probably wrong, and you know, that it's much more amorphous than that. It's much more about how you interpret things. That leads to the better outcome. It sounds like that's what you're saying.
Well, obviously I would start from saying that, you know, I speak from a particular perspective, and obviously, you know, I don't have any access to any greater level of truth than other people do. But these are my opinions.
Well, other than the fact that you've studied for many more years than most people.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that I know what I'm talking about, right?
Okay.
So, you know, but I will say that I might personally feel like a lot of American Christianity is misguided, but misguided is probably not the term that I would want to use, because I think that for the most part, the things that motivate people to come to religious communities in the first place are very rational, necessary drives and needs that are part of being human. People want community. They want to find meaning in the world. They want to find guidance on how to live. They want to find ways to raise their kids in ways that will help them grow up to be, you know, fine, upstanding members of society. They want to find ways to follow their dreams and their goal and make their goals happen. And you know, religion plays a huge part of that for a lot of people. And people come to certain kinds of Christian churches looking for answers, and they're given answers. And there's nothing wrong with somebody purveying answers. There's nothing wrong with somebody trying to explain the way the world works in religious terms, that, you know, God wanted your life to go this way and therefore it did. There's nothing wrong with that. And I just, what I would look for and hope for is more self-reflection. I think that's what's sadly lacking in a lot of American Christianity. And it's not that I necessarily oppose people thinking in a more conservative fashion than I do. It's that attitude of, we are right, you are wrong. Because we're right, God's going to kill you and send you to hell, or make your life miserable, or somehow judge your country or whatever. And it's this sort of
But the whole of religion is premised on the fact that God's commands are to a large extent knowable, or what God's will is to a large extent knowable.
See, I don't know necessarily about it. I mean, like, you say the whole premise of religion as
modern Christianity. I feel like if you take away the idea that we can know things for 100%, you know, the whole house of cards, a lot of their houses of cards will fall down. Like, I have seen pastors rail against the dangers of postmodernism, and it's like, it makes sense to me that, hey, you know, the book was written over the course of hundreds, thousands of years, and different translations, different whatever, we can't know for sure what's going on. Humans chose what books ended up in the Bible. You know, like, we can't know what's really the Word of God, what's not. I understand that a lot of people think that's like the devil's talk.
Yeah, and I can understand why that would feel that way. I mean, because what it does is it fundamentally troubles the notion that we can find a purpose for our lives in this text, or that we can find a guide for how to live.
Right. And you think we can't necessarily?
I think that we can. I think that we can perfectly well use these texts within certain contexts, within the context of a community that deems them authoritative. I think people are perfectly free to use those to guide their lives, and that's not something I think is bad. I think it's important to
to find sources of authority and...
yeah, but that's like a really positivist view of things, is it not?
Well, no, positivism is the idea that we can sort of scientifically determine what is, you know, what is knowable and what's not knowable, or what's true and what's not true.
It sounded similar to what you're saying.
That ultimately, you know, people make meaning out of text, and that's just what we do. You make meaning out of every text you read. But I think, you know, people have put an unjustifiable amount of certainty into how we interpret the Bible. It's not that clear of a text. You know, it takes interpretation. Even the most inerrantist biblical scholar needs to interpret the text. It needs to figure out how to make it say something.
But your whole formulation reorients the entire focus from God communicating with us to us making sense of these scraps of text, basically.
I mean,
like, that's the focus, is like how humans make sense of it. That's where the value comes from, it seems like, what you're saying.
Yeah. I think that how humans, how we produce meaning is the most important part. And how do we both make that meaning, and how do we...
To be clear, a lot of people would think that is, heretical or something?
Yeah.
Okay.
Fine. But it's not... Okay. But, you know, the idea that we can't easily get answers out of the text is not necessarily new in Christian theology.
I agree.
There have been powerful strains in Christian theology for centuries that have emphasized the unknowability of God, our inability to fully plumb the depths of that reality, and you know, there are elements of skepticism that are built into the history of Christianity that can be drawn upon to think with, that are not quite so hubristic in their certainty that we possess the ability to get the meaning out of the text that is truth with a capital T, you know. And I think the problem of much American Christianity is this sense of certainty that it holds on to, that it has access to that capital T truth, and also, frankly, what also scares me is the way in which that gets tied to a kind of ultranationalism, that somehow Christianity and America get mixed, that truth becomes mixed with a certain way of viewing American history and a certain way of viewing America's role in the world, and I think that's dangerous. It's not new. Religion and nationalism and ethnicity get mixed and played with all throughout human history, but strikes me as being particularly frightening because it's my country and it's the country I live in. I don't want it to turn anymore into a scary, you know, conservative, you know, religio-nationalistic movement. But
all right. So to answer the original question, God is inconsistent throughout the Bible.
Yes, but that's you know, to say that is to put it in the most negative terms, and it's important to say it in those negative terms to correct certain kinds of, I think, facile assumptions about what the text is doing. But to say it in more
generous, charitable.
Generous, charitable terms is that each of the books of the Bible has its own perspective of God. It has its own way of imagining how God is speaking to their community and their time and place. The people, you know, I talked earlier about how Revelation is essentially a bloodbath, and it is a bloodbath, but it's written by a community that feels itself persecuted by forces outside of its control. And it imagines a scenario in which their persecution by these larger forces is put to an end by the violent actions of God, who fights on their behalf, you know, who comes to their aid. And, you know, when that kind of thinking becomes canonical and it becomes a way of viewing God, that becomes dangerous to me. But when it comes out of a longing for reprieve from social and political marginalization, that to me doesn't seem so scary and so terrible. And in fact, can be kind of liberating. You know, it can be a way of finding the courage to stand up against forces beyond your control if you think that ultimately God is going to vindicate your side. You know, what becomes dangerous is when one ties that the message of God's ultimate deliverance of your people to, you know, you taking up a gun and starting to kill people. That's where it becomes dangerous. But the notion that God is ultimately going to vindicate you can inspire acts of courage that we need people to be able to have in the face of political, economic injustice. So, I mean...
So it's not all bad.
It's not all bad. It's just... It's that the Bible is both an inspiring and an awful text. It is. It can produce, if interpreted and read one way, it can produce terrible, horrible things. But it can also inspire people to do great and wonderful things. And I think we have to struggle with the ambiguity of the text, and we have to confront it if we want to avoid becoming the people that do terrible things in the name of God. You know.
Last question. We have like 2-3 minutes left on this. You were saying how if there is a God, he has a lot to answer for. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, if there is a God, you'd think he could communicate a little bit more clearly. If there is a God...
But couldn't you say he did it that way for a reason?
Oh, I'm sure.
The Lord works in mysterious ways.
Fine. But at some point, he should probably tell us what that reason is. You know, like, I mean, I can do any number of things and have a reason for them. But if, you know, at the end of the day, I have to lay my cards on the table and say, okay, I made these choices for these reasons, you know.
Right. Or maybe it's like Lost, where you find out there's all these things that are brought up, it's not explained.
We just thought it'd be cool to do this, you know. I just thought it'd be cool to do it this way, you know. Sorry about that, you know. I thought earthquakes would be kind of fun as a way of you know creating mountains over the course of long eons of time. I'm sorry if a lot of people died in the process, but I just thought it'd be kind of cool to watch, you know.
Yeah.
Like, look, you know. Ultimately, you
hopefully
know,
he'll explain that.
Ultimately, I think you know God is going to have to make an accounting himself for how he has behaved. If there is a God, he's going to have.
Couldn't you argue? Well, in the Book of Job, where he's like, "How can the pot ask the potter, why was I made this way?"
Then the potter shouldn't have given the pot like the capacity to think and reason. You know what
exactly.
I mean? Like,
exactly.
I mean, and, you know, the Book of Job is such a fascinating. I think it's an even more. It's an even more troubling text than I think we have generally given it credit for. The Book of Job ends with God accepting Job's premise that Job did nothing wrong to deserve this, and Job never finds out that he was just basically the victim of God making a bet. We know it because we read it in the first chapters, but Job never knows this.
Yeah.
God never says, "Oh, by the way, I made a bet. You did a good job of winning." You know, but he affirms that Job is ultimately a righteous guy, didn't do anything wrong, and suffers unjustifiably, and that God made him suffer unjustifiably, and God.
But that Job should not be able to question that.
No, but God puts up this big bluster. He puts up this big front. He just gets up there in all of his finery and majesty and power, and just says, "You can't ask this question." And ultimately, the Book of Job ends with the notion, not with the notion of like God is that there is actually an order to society or a purpose in life. It actually ends with God doesn't seem to have an answer either. God doesn't seem to be able to.
Okay, we got interrupted there by someone. God doesn't seem to have an answer either. You're saying.
No, God doesn't seem to have an answer for why these things happen. God is the guy who puts up a whole big front at the end of the story, because he ultimately isn't in control either. You know,
of what he allows.
Yeah, I mean, the ending of Job is that life is actually far more capricious than we could ever think it would be, and that ultimately God might not even have the answers to why these things happen.
But in a way, I feel like that's more reassuring than that God does all these things.
It is. It really is. You know. I think it pushes us to confront the capriciousness of life, and I think we have to do that. And if we don't do that, we are giving ourselves over to certainties that don't ultimately hold up, and can lead to greater problems than they end up solving.